Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude, Part 2.
We begin our show every day, and we have and we will continue to do between now and the election of 2020 with the powerful words of Colonel Vindman in his opening statement in the impeachment hearing of November of 2019. He reminds his father that it will be all right. And as we've come to learn, nothing is all right.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And of course, if it's Friday, it's Scott Braddock. And if it's Scott Braddock, it's the voice of Texas. But before we begin with Mr. Braddock, please excuse me. We begin every show now, Scott, with the words of Colonel Vindman when he testified in November of 2019.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Congress. And I'm going to just remind the audience that the next words you hear are Colonel Vindman testifying, assuring his father he will be all right. And what I want to remind everyone is not only is he not all right, but we are not all right. So hold on, Colonel Vindman. Okay, welcome back, Scott. So here's the deal. Scott, things are crazy in the country. You are covering Texas, which is the size of a country in and of itself. It
Yes.
has a GDP that would be the equivalent of probably most countries in Europe, if not
mm-hmm.
more.
Right.
How is Governor Abbott, how is the state legislature, which is on hiatus because it only mm-hmm. meets for, you know, one time every 2 years, how is your state functioning? And are you seeing a Republican governor stepping up to some extent to the same fashion that we're seeing with like an Andrew Cuomo? It seems like the Democratic governors, except for perhaps the Republican governor of Maryland, mm-hmm. seem to be more prepared to respond to COVID-19. And there seems to be a partisan divide in how the Republicans are responding.
If there's a partisan divide, it was created by the President of the United States. You may have seen that the Washington Post, they put up a video, I think yesterday, either Wednesday or Thursday, they put up a video of just showing the side by side of what folks on Fox News Channel were saying about this crisis last week versus what they're saying now. And of course, Fox News takes their cues from President Trump, who, you know, even a week and a half ago or so, the president was still saying, you know, this may go away, this may all get better. But earlier in the week, what did he get? Well, the reporting was that his administration was looking at a report that said that this virus could kill as many as 2.2 million people. And that's when things started to get more restrictive. When you looked at the recommendations from the CDC, had said what, Arnie? That people should not gather in groups of more than 50. Well, after that report about the 2.2 million people potentially dying, that's when the president said, no, only 10 people should gather at any one place, no more than 10 people. Just this afternoon, the governor of Texas, who has been slow on this, and look, we've been prodding him along. There were Republican and Democratic governors alike who had already said there were disaster declarations, emergency declarations in their states. The governor last Friday had issued an emergency declaration for all 254 counties of Texas across the 30 million people in two time zones. Just today, he issued an executive order that calls for the following. Same thing as what the CDC and the president had said. No social gatherings of more than 10 people. Also, restaurants and bars, food courts, gymnasiums, massage parlors, etc., should all be closed for food. People can still go to the drive-thru, still get pickup or delivery options. Those are still there for people. They also said that folks can't go to nursing homes to visit their elderly relatives. You can only be at a nursing home, according to this executive order, if you're there to provide critical assistance. And finally, all the schools in Texas, across our more than 1,000 school districts all across the state, all schools are closed. This, Arnie, is in place for at least the next 2 weeks. This may be a deal where they're trying to gather data exactly how all this is playing out, and they'll look at the numbers and say, do we need to keep doing this or not? And the governor, lieutenant governor, and the speaker of the House today at the Texas Capitol were saying that the length of this, what some folks are going to think are extreme measures, the length of this is determined by how well Texans, and I would think in other states, how well the residents of those states, how closely they adhere to this stuff. I mean, these are not orders that are in line with a shelter in place. People can still move about, still go outside your house, still go to the grocery store. You can still go to your place of business, but you've got to, your employers were asked to please limit how many people are in an office at any one place and only have the absolutely essential folks at the office. Everybody else encouraged to work from home, work remotely, social distancing. People stay away from each other. Let me tell you what happened with me earlier this week. My power went out at my house, and so I went to one of the hotels in downtown Austin to stay for a couple of days. When I first arrived, Arnie, the restaurant and the bar, those were open on Monday afternoon into Monday evening. Before there was a mandatory order in Austin, Texas, to close bars and restaurants on St. Patty's Day, by the way, that came down at lunchtime on St. Patrick's Day. Before that, some of the restaurants were already closing in the hotel that had happened. By the next day, the food options in the hotel became more limited. At some point, the people who work in the hotel were wearing rubber gloves. I didn't see anybody wearing a mask, but that's probably on the way. And the way they were starting to sort of shut down the things and the operations inside the hotel, you would think at some point they would just lock the front door. But I had asked the guy at the front desk, what is the actual capacity right now? What's the hotel occupancy? And for the hotel where I was staying, they were at about 15%. The hotel across the street, 5%. And right up the street, the Four Seasons Austin at 3.4% capacity. And I'm already hearing today about folks who work in restaurants, hospitality, et cetera, who are either being furloughed or laid off outright. Right now, this is going to have incredible economic implications. You ask how the state is doing overall. Not only are we in the throes of COVID-19, but earlier in the week, as you know, it was actually the week before, we saw the price of oil collapse, for this state, and we talked about it last week on the show, it's the number one single best indicator of the overall health of the state of Texas economy. Oil right now, as I talk to you, is about $25 a barrel. Yesterday, it was at 20, and we depend on oil and gas production for state revenues here. This has major implications for the way we pay for our schools, the way we pay for our roads, the way we pay for healthcare. There are some folks who are in the Houston area right now who are either bar and restaurant owners, or they work with those various businesses, and they were asking if the state could hold off on collecting sales taxes for the last month. Those taxes come due in the next 24 hours. So as this interview will be airing, Arnie, they're supposed to be paying their taxes. And I think after Hurricane Harvey, I'm pretty sure on this, I'm going to double check it. After Hurricane Harvey in the Houston area, those taxes were able to be deferred so that those restaurants and bars and other businesses like that, those establishments would be able to, you know, keep some of that money and keep their folks on payroll. The issue this time around, though, is that if those sales taxes, which were paid for by Texans who, you know, went to those establishments over the last month, if they don't go to the state, then they won't be handed back down to the local entities, including, Arnie, the hospital districts around the state. And the hospital districts are the ones that are going to be trying to find beds for people as this disaster continues to grow. Earlier in the week, the governor had said, don't be shocked, don't be surprised if the number of people who are found to be confirmed infected with COVID-19 in the state grows exponentially. Again, state of 30 million people, 254 counties. As of last week, we only had about 50 people who had been infected. Earlier in the week, there was one death from COVID-19 in Texas. Now we're up to 3 deaths from COVID-19 in Texas. By the end of this week, by tomorrow, we should see capacity at about 10,000 tests per week across the state. And if you haven't been doing testing, Arnie, in a wide, in a broad sort of way like that, then you don't really have a real picture of what's going on. So right. we're going to start to get what that real picture is. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if some of the restrictive measures that have been put in place for folks don't get more restrictive.
Okay, so we're talking Texas, and I really think this is an important conversation because it must be in your headlines. It must be part of the political conversation. There are two stories here. One is the border and the fact that we have been warehousing so many of those undocumented immigrants that have come across the border, the refugees, whatever, what's happening to them. Two, the fact that you have millions of undocumented immigrants that live in Texas. How are we going to be dealing with that issue? We've got issues with ICE. Is ICE on ICE and not dealing with this anymore? How are they going to be treated when it comes to the necessities of life? Not only a COVID-19 test, if one becomes available, not only access to healthcare, if they may need it. What about how they eat? What about how they shelter? What about how they basically stay alive? Because you can't have, for example, in Houston, suddenly having 500,000 people who are underground but terribly necessary to an economy, but suddenly that economy tanks and they can't get the $1,000 check. They can't qualify for Medicaid. They can't collect unemployment. Who the hell is thinking about what happens to them? Because they are part of the fabric of that society. And I know that they're quote unquote undocumented, but in the end, they live there.
You know, one of the people who runs a legal center that deals with the undocumented population had said that when they started some of their efforts to try to offer legal aid to these farm workers and others who are in either in places like California or Texas, they had said, look, coronavirus was nowhere on the agenda when they were putting their plans together months ago. Right. But now there's this new layer of fear, as you say. We have Trump administration policies which keep some of these folks from coming forward for sure. As they become ill, that may change. We'll see. I think there's some confusion when it comes to immigration and customs enforcement. And we saw the story just in the last couple of days, Arnie, that the crackdown on the southern border is coming just as the United States recorded its 100th death from COVID-19. We saw earlier in the day that the Trump administration had worked out a deal with our neighbors to the north, with Canada, to say, you know, that sort of leisure travel between the two countries is not going to be allowed for right now. They're going to try to keep that from impacting trade. But I think, you know, in the long term, figuring this out is going to be very difficult. And here in Texas, we have a huge undocumented population, you know, more than, you know, roughly 2 million people at least. Right. Who are not documented in this estate and probably about 600,000 in the Houston area alone.
Right. So here's what I'm trying to figure out. So this isn't a border issue. This is a live there issue. Okay. So this isn't about cracking down on the border because they're here and they've been here in some cases, 10 years, 20 years, 2 weeks, who knows. I want to know who is leading the conversation about what is going to happen to 2 million. Let me repeat this. 2 million people who, you know, they've been conveniently ignored or they've been in the shadows or they've picked your fruit or they've worked in the oil fields, but they're there. I mean, that's the reality. Is there anyone in the Texas legislature, is there anyone in the administration that is basically saying, we have to deal with this problem? If we have a problem for the rest of Texas, this is a significant problem because this will just compound our ability to be able to respond and protect everyone.
Arnie, it's something that isn't top of mind at the moment. I think that it's a good question. But when we talk about the realities of undocumented people in Texas, it maybe isn't quite what folks from other parts of the country think of, that there are sort of these 2 million people that we have to deal with. Obviously, that's true. However, people who are undocumented they're in every facet of our life in this state. Like you said, they work across industries. They're in construction, they're in farm work, they're in other industries as well. And when they get healthcare in Houston, for example, or in Dallas, it's not uncommon for their employer, who may be paying them under the table, to drop them off on the sidewalk. I've seen this happen many times in the construction industry. Drop them off on the sidewalk. They go into Ben Taub, which is one of the big public hospitals in Houston, and they will be treated. But you can guess what kind of treatment it is. It's, you know, the folks at the hospital are doing their best But this is a taxpayer-funded hospital. It's on the backs of everybody who's paying skyrocketing property taxes to be able to make up the difference for those hospital districts. And so it's going to be an incredible public cost. There is a conversation to definitely be had, and I've heard some of this already sort of roiling within the healthcare community, that this COVID-19 outbreak might be the thing that finally breaks the back of the anti-Medicaid expansion arguments in the state. We've come so far from the day when Obamacare was first enacted, the Affordable Care Act with the opportunity to draw down more federal dollars for uncompensated care in the state needs to happen. Republicans seem to be a little more, at least privately, a little more willing to do that now. Part of that has to do with the fact that it's been some time since President Obama was in office.
Let me just stop you. Isn't your state one of the states that's suing about the Affordable Care Act?
I
want to remind everyone, Texas has the highest percentage of uninsured in America. I want to repeat this. The highest percentage of uninsured in America. It did not embrace the expansion of Medicaid. It trashed the Affordable Care Act, just like Donald Trump trashed the Affordable Care Act. Your attorney general, I believe, sued to basically find it unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And now I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm trying not to chuckle, but it's kind of ironic that all of a sudden this is coming back in a way that's roaring back to bite you in the proverbial ass.
It's more than ironic, Arnie. It's that when they do the numbers on this, whether you're talking about the healthcare policy analysts, within state government, or folks who work at, various healthcare companies, as they start to insurers, et cetera, as they try to figure out exactly what the path forward is. If you just do it by the numbers, it always comes back to Medicaid expansion is the thing that we should be doing to try to extend more coverage to folks.
So, what's happening with your hospitals? If I listen to Governor Cuomo one more time, I'm going to have a heart attack because I'm so upset about what's happening. We know they don't have the masks. They don't have the nurses. Mm-hmm. We know they don't have, they don't have anything. Mm-hmm. Texas is such an interesting place. It's a lot like New York in that way. Some of the most successful, richest corporations on the planet mm-hmm. are based in Texas. Some of the richest, most successful companies on the planet are based in New York. I see an incompetent mm-hmm. president. I see a president who's dragging his feet. And I think I'm seeing a president who'd rather see somebody else take this burden from him. What are we seeing from the corporate side, the private side of Texas with these incredibly wildly successful companies? Because in the end, not only are they being trashed, I understand, by the dropping oil prices, mm-hmm. and that's going to be horrific, but in the end, they need to have something to come back to. And while they may be hurt, they need to make sure that there is something in the way of economic and health stability. Are they stepping up to assist the hospitals? Are they stepping up and offering services? What are they doing?
It's an interesting question, Arnie. It's not one that I've explored so far. The reality is in Texas, just like in a lot of other places, the capacity of the hospital system is going to be proven to be inadequate, I think, in Texas, in New York, all these other places. In somewhere like Tarrant County, for example, which is where Fort Worth is, mm-hmm. I believe there are under 400 ICU beds in the entire county. That's a county of 2 million people. And so if you look at the fact that we don't have capacity, we don't have the triage centers, the fever clinics, et cetera, at the kind of high patient volumes that we may see over the next few weeks, as more tests become available, as, the 10,000 tests per week that were promised by the governor become available, we're going to see more folks come in with this ailment, more folks come in who need treatment. And we're about to find out, as one of the healthcare lobbyists I trust the other day said, we're going to find out exactly how under-hospitalized Texas and the entire United States really is.
Well, we know we're under-hospitalized. We know that the number of beds we have per person compared to, for example, Italy is disgusting. And part of the reason is because we've had a porous healthcare system. People have been uninsured, underinsured. They can't afford their co-pays. So we've really never had to take care of everybody. That's never been our job. Our job was you're on your own, Jack. And if you didn't have access to healthcare, we could sort of roll our eyes. And everyone keeps saying, go to an emergency room.
It's just too bad.
It is too bad. So as I was listening to you, I was thinking of something that I used to do when I wrote for the Boston Globe. When I wrote for the Boston Globe, I borrowed something from Harper's Magazine. And Harper's Magazine had something called the Harper's Index. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-hmm.
So the Harper's Index, for those of you who don't know, was a series of statements, but it always ended with a number. All right. So and so it became useful because if you were a numbers person, you'd read the statement and there was this convenient, it would always end with a number and you would go down the list. And I used to do the Arnie Index. As I'm listening to you, I almost want to get some numbers for you or make a suggestion that we should sort of write together the Texas New Hampshire Index. Mm-hmm. And I'm a state of 1.3 million people. You were talking about a county of 2 million people. I think we have three times the number of ICU beds, maybe four times what you have. And we're a state of 1.3. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a way for people to understand that it's also going to be an accident of geography, whether you actually get access to a healthcare system. And that not only did Texas decide not to expand Medicaid, not only does Texas have this huge number of uninsured and underinsured, not only does it see a significant number of bankruptcies, but now the people who are insured, now the rich, now the Republicans, now the people that even work in the oil and gas industry, they're not going to have a bed because you never made the requisite investment that people should have a bed.
Let me shift the conversation just a little bit because I think you've made the point very well. But I do think that it's worth saying that the way that we fund things in Texas is being turned on its head at this moment. As I mentioned, you have $25 or $20 per barrel West Texas Intermediate oil. Here is a letter that was sent by the Texas House and Senate Transportation Chairman just yesterday, Arnie. We had reported this when oil was at $20 a barrel, and they were talking about the way we're going to fund roads in Texas moving forward, which is, of course, a giant cost, especially when you have 1,200 people continuing to move to Texas every single day. They're going to bring cars, right? There is a unified transportation plan in this state, which we use to look out over the next decade for how we're going to spend our transportation dollars. And this is the language that the Senate Transportation Chairman chose to use in his letter asking the Department of Transportation to hit pause on the unified transportation plan. Are you ready? Here's what he said.
Okay.
He said, quote, "There is immense volatility in the global financial markets, a near collapse in the oil market, and the threat of a potential recession," unquote. This is not from somebody who's an alarmist. I've known that chairman for a long time. He's somebody who's a realist, not a flamethrower. He is a Republican conservative, but he's no Tea Party guy or anything like that. This is somebody who's very measured in his comments over the years that I've known him. And for him to be saying, we're looking at a potential recession, it means that I think a lot of the ways that we do things around here, and I would guess the ways that things are done in other states, going to be turned on their heads. There's going to be real conversations about how we do these things going forward, potentially a big reset for Texas and the rest of the nation.
As we address
all of these things from schools, healthcare, transportation, all the things that are the big ticket items, we may have to figure out completely new ways to fund these things, completely new ways to do these things.
So I've been thinking a lot about this COVID-19, and I've been thinking about the people that are on the front lines. And for the most part, it's actually women. It's the nurses. That's the people who are going to be, I mean, because a lot of this isn't about an operation. This isn't about, you know, something that you'd have to go to medical school for. This is what nurses do, okay? Yeah. Right. And they really are the front line. And I'm in a way I'm thinking about every war we've sent the boys over. And now we're at an interesting war. In some ways, maybe more cataclysmic than any war, World War I, World War II, the Korean War. And it's happening now to all of us. And the soldiers are women. Isn't that amazing, Scott? Mm. It's the women that are the soldiers. And I want people to understand that. You know, when I ran for governor, people kept talking about the fact that I cared about the soft issues, like healthcare and the environment and all those things. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wasn't going to be a good governor, because we needed a guy. Well, it turns out all those soft issues is what we should have addressed 30 years ago. Because now, by not dealing with it, we're being taken to our knees. And I just want to thank every female out there. You are the caregivers. And during a COVID-19, Scott, it's the caregivers they're going to make the difference in our lives. It's really kind of shocking as I'm thinking about it. Anyway, Scott Braddock.
I think so too. I think so too, Arnie. You know the African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. This whole thing about social distancing, it turns that sort of on its head, right? Because we all kind of have to stay apart. But just keep in mind, we are all doing it together, and we all have to do it because it's about the broader community, not just in your state, not just in your country, but about your whole world.
And I want everyone to know that that's why I love Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He's the voice of Texas. He's the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And Scott, we found you many, many years ago when Rick Perry was running for president for about 14 minutes. And we started a segment known as Indictment Watch. God, it seems like a millennial ago.
Arnie, listen, he got indicted and I got invited to the show.
Thank you. We've got to use that. That's fabulous. Anyway, Scott Braddock, please, please, please stay well. Continue to cover Texas. Ask the tough questions. And then on Friday, share the answers with us. We love you. Thank you so much.
Y'all stay safe. We'll talk soon.
All right, stick around, everyone, for part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude. Thank you, Scott.
All right. Talk to y'all next week.
All right, talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Teaching kids to save water on this current cast. Hear the pitter-patter of little feet around your house? If so, you can teach your children to keep their water footprints small, even as they grow in size. The key is to make water conservation fun and simple. Try approaching it like a game. For example, help your kids read the meter and then see if your family can use less from week to week. Set goals and rewards for success. When your children brush their teeth, show them how to shut off the faucet so it does not drip. Teach older kids to take shorter showers and set an example by practicing water conservation yourself. These simple lessons can help your kids develop lifelong habits and an appreciation for our natural resources. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott.
I'm looking at the Washington Monthly, and I actually go to that magazine a lot. And I saw an article by Paul Glastras. He is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly. But Paul, you are so much more than that. So before we start with the article that you wrote, and perhaps even another article that was recently posted at the Washington Monthly, can you share with my audience a little bit about you other than your connection to the Washington Monthly?
Well, I'm a St. Louis native and a St. Louis Cardinal fan of Greek descent. What do you want to know?
Well, a little bit of your political history.
Okay, well, I've been mostly a journalist all my life, but spent 2.5 years as a speechwriter for President Clinton in the last 2.5 years of his administration, and dabbled a little bit in politics that way and government. But mostly just been a policy journalist and been running the Washington Monthly for the last, 18 years.
Well, I wanted people to know that you'd written over 200 speeches for Bill Clinton, because you have to get his cadence. You have to be in his head. You have to know his words. That's a different talent than a journalist talent. I just want to let everyone know. So welcome to the program. Wrote a piece.
That is so true. That is.
Oh, I know. I mean, people try to write.
Doing my Clinton impression here.
Yeah, you're such a, but you wrote a piece, and I posted it on Facebook, and the comments have been wild. But it was entitled "Biden Should Pick Warren as Vice President," and basically you said, like, now, immediately, do it. Give me your pitch. What is the rationale? Elizabeth Warren dropped out of this race. She did not say who she would endorse, but she's gone back into her old mode, which is my favorite Elizabeth mode, which is she's like a staccato with policy after policy after policy, but not huge policy papers, but policy positions that come out quickly. She does them in a tweet. She can do them during an interview. And when you realize what she's saying, you're like, God, I want this woman to be in charge. But obviously, that's not going to be the case. So talk to me a little bit about why you think Biden should embrace her. Everyone's assuming it's going to be a woman of color. We know it's going to be a woman. Now the question is, which one?
Right. So I don't know. But let me just say that Elizabeth Warren, a couple of days ago, put out a tweet thread that basically said, look, if we're going to provide bailouts for huge companies, here are the terms we should ask for. And went on to say things like minimum wage of $15, right of worker representatives to be on the boards, the end of stock buybacks. You know, the airlines want a bailout, but they've spent all of the huge revenues that they've enjoyed in recent years buying back the stock. So now their coffers are empty. Had they not done that, we wouldn't have to bail them out. So just a whole bunch of requirements that would in themselves be a form of structural change of the rules of capitalism. And that is, as you say, what makes Elizabeth Warren a kind of unique figure in American politics, certainly in the presidential race. And my thought was he said he's going to pick a woman. I think he picks her. I think he picks her now. And the reason is suddenly Elizabeth Warren, if she is the designated, she has to say yes, right? We don't know that.
Right,
she would,
right, of course.
I think she would. That once he picks her, he can basically say also, she is my designated person in the Senate. I don't have a vote in the Senate, right, but she does. Right. And she's speaking for me. And I'm behind these ideas of hers to have a quid pro quo for any stimulus or bailout that is going to itself be a reform of the system. What does that do? First of all, remember, it is at the moment when corporations are coming hat in hand to the government for a bailout, where you have them over the barrel and you can have some reforms that otherwise are never going to happen, right? Because they have no leverage. And right now the Republicans are in a way that they were not when Barack Obama was first elected. Right. They're willing to throw a bunch of money at this. And so it's the Democrats that have the leverage, and they can demand and get some major, major concessions. So I don't think this is something that you wait around for. I think he does it now. And what does that do? First of all, it sends a message to all the folks who were Elizabeth Warren fans that we hear you. And who are these folks? A lot of them are exactly the people who went out and voted and organized and ran for office. It's the middle-aged, educated suburban women out there. Second of all, I think that provides a bridge to a lot of the Bernie supporters,
right,
who want to see somebody. They know Bernie's not going to be the nominee, but suddenly you've said, you know, we hear you, and this person who has some ideas very similar to Bernie's is now going to be on the ticket. And if he wins, if she and he wins in the White House. And so that provides a bridge for them to cross over to support Biden. Nothing is more important right now than uniting the left and the moderate wings of the Democratic Party. So that does that. But what it also does, right, is it puts Joe Biden in the position of, through remote control, through, you know, though he doesn't have a vote in the Senate, Elizabeth Warren is his designated person. He's following Elizabeth Warren's lead on policy. And that strengthens her hand in these battles we're going to have over, it's going to unify Democrats around her idea, because they're going to know she's speaking for the presumptive Democratic nominee. And
on every level, I love it. Okay. And let's also remember that I remember the story of Elizabeth Warren going down to Houston, Texas. And it was African-American women that were coming in from all over the country. And Kamala was still in the race and all these other people. I think there were still 22 people running. She blew these women away. They loved her. She got the greatest reception because the things that she was talking about, they could directly relate to. Yep. It went directly to their lives. It went to their struggles. It was a solution with their name on it. It was, I can't even tell you how excited it was. I don't know what happened from that point in time and how that sort of message kind of a little bit evaporated, because I thought, oh my God, she can do what nobody else can do. Right. I mean, even Kamala was there and she wasn't getting the same kind of reception as Elizabeth was. She got the big sort of roaring, you know, standing ovation. Here's my thought. I agree with you. A little Bernie people are a little bit nervous about her, but, you know, get a life. She's basically, you know what she is? She's Bernie with white papers.
Right.
I mean, that's really what she is. And the fact that she says she's not a socialist, I hate to break it to you, Bernie ain't a socialist either. He's in a word rut. He's been saying the word socialist for 40 years, and he thinks he still is. And when I talk to my friends in Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, all those places he refers to, they look at me, they roll their eyes, and they say, we don't use that word anymore, Arnie. We're compassionate capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of, you know, I kind of wish it, but here's my concern. I think you're absolutely right, but there is a Republican governor named Charlie Baker. He is the Republican governor of Massachusetts. If she ends up becoming the VP, that leaves that seat vacant. You and I both know the most important thing is also to basically remove Mitch McConnell. He is a blight on society. He's been horrific in every way. Even during the COVID-19 thing, he's dragging his knuckles. Even during the COVID-19 thing, he's hurting everyone by not responding in a nimble and quick way for whatever hell of the reason is. And we already know what he's done to the courts. So what do we do about that? I don't know whether we're going to have such a huge cushion in the Senate, let alone win the Senate, to give Charlie Baker the ability to nominate someone. And it might be a liberal, even moderate Republican, but the operative word here is Republican.
Look, that is a very, very legitimate concern. And I share your belief that it's not worth putting the Senate at risk. If the Democrats take the Senate, it will be, they're going to have to draw an inside straight. They've got to really win 5 seats.
Right.
Because they're going to lose Alabama. They're going to lose probably Doug Jones. They can do it. There's a lot of Senate Republican seats in play, but it's not a sure thing. It's anything but a sure thing. And taking a senator you know, out of that deck that's a sure Republican, that is a, that would be a very bad thing. Let me, I think the answer to your question is actually pretty simple. The Democrats have a supermajority in the legislature in Massachusetts. They can pass a law that says any replacement for a, you know, in a, for a, for a senator has to be from the party of that senator. There are a number of states that have such a law. Charlie Baker won't like it. The Republican Party will go ballistic, but it's
democratic. Couldn't he veto it, Paul? Because he's the governor, he could veto it. You need, so you'd need a wild majority.
Right, but I don't know. You're gonna, you know, New England politics better than I do, but I know that they have a supermajority of Democrats in the legislature, and you know whether they have a veto-proof majority for such a bill, that I don't know, but that would be the way out.
Wow. Or the other thing is that an election has to be called within 3 months.
Right, right.
I mean, that way they still have a shot. Well, it's not
and you know, I don't know who the Democrats have who they can put up for the next election, because there's going to be a special election. I believe it's within 6 months. I don't recall. Yeah. But if, say, Charlie Baker puts a Republican in there, all right, that person has a slight advantage in that they're sitting in the seat. But it's not a huge advantage. It's not necessarily something somebody.
No. I remember she defeated the Republican that, you know, that.
That's right. So if President Biden, if it happens to be President Biden, is deprived of a Senate majority because of this, that could change 6 months in. So, you know, it's tricky. You know, name me somebody to put in that vice presidential slot who doesn't have downsides.
Okay, so have you read any of the comments on your piece? You know me, I'm a good little doobie. And the only thing that someone said was that you're taking her out of the Senate, that she could, in fact, maybe be not necessarily the majority leader, but that she would have a very, very powerful role in the Senate, especially if the Senate was in control by the Democrats. And that, you know, as a VP, isn't she a bit, I mean, I know she's female, but isn't she a bit castrated? Someone wrote the article like you're putting her in a glass jar that says break when Biden dies, you know, and that's really her role as VP. Or do you think that you would see a VP a la Cheney and George Bush?
Well, I was in a White House where the vice president was Al Gore. And I can assure you the power of the vice presidency in the modern presidency is vast. Gore staffers could walk in and often did walk in on just about any meeting that was going on. A smart vice president can be very, very powerful. George, as you said, Dick Cheney was extraordinarily powerful. It's not the vice presidency of 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. Elizabeth Warren, you know, frankly, has more ideas and more of a vision for domestic policy anyway, you know, in a day than frankly, Joe Biden has in a week.
No. Actually, this is in a lot of ways. We've always talked about the fact that we really shouldn't have one president. We should have two.
Right.
One that is knowledgeable about foreign policy and one that's knowledgeable about domestic policy. Because in the end, there's usually a weakness in one or the other. And what you're telling me, and I'm mirroring this back to you, is that in a way, she's the domestic person and he's the foreign person. And if you listen to him talk, he's so much happier when he's talking foreign policy.
No question. And this idea that she'll be more powerful in the Senate than she will in the White House, anybody who understands how Washington really works understands that's probably not true. We live in an executive branch world. Congress is has a shadow of its former power. There may come a day when they take that power back, but the presidency is where the action is. And to be independently, by the way, elected, right?
Right, right.
And to have your own staff, and you know, remember, Biden is going to be beholden to her, right?
Yeah.
Basically, she's not going to say yes, and I'll keep my mouth shut and stop talking about my issues. Oh, he's going to have to swallow her issues to get her.
Well, and let's also, let me just say something else. He's already started to swallow with bankruptcy. I mean,
he's already
acknowledged that, you know, which is already
accepted her bankruptcy bill.
Yes, exactly. So, and the other thing I've been thinking a lot about is, so we're watching Donald Trump, who's a role model for nothing except for perhaps corruption, idiocy, and lies. But what has been so fascinating is to watch how, given this COVID thing, which is the worst thing that's ever happened to this country, probably since the Civil War, is that it's really all Pence all the time.
Right. Right.
And what I am hearing from you is that what you see with Elizabeth is that what you get with Elizabeth is Elizabeth always talks about corruption, corruption, corruption. She also talks about putting some kind of corporate controls. She also realizes if we're cutting you a check, then we get something for this check.
That's
other
right.
than a payback, you know, that you can pay back in one way. But the payback that you have to do is how you treat your employees, how you treat the economy, and how you treat, you know, the suppliers that work with you. In other words, you have to be a good corporate citizen.
Arnie, I got an email from a very smart guy who said, I'm concerned that because some of the things you hear, oh, she's 70 years old, we need somebody younger. This guy said, you know, I'm concerned that he picked somebody who's ready to be president in 2028. And I kind of did a, you know, palm on the forehead kind of thing. You know, we're in the midst of, you know, a coming recession. We've had mass downward mobility for the middle and lower income classes for a generation or two. And we've got a moment right now where we can rewrite the social contract of America. And I give people like Bernie credit, you know, Bernie Sanders credit for this shift among Democrats and among some Republicans. And with this coronavirus, we've got, you know, a chance to really, really affect policy in a way that was not possible before, because you've got both parties. And to be worried about, oh, what's going to happen? I mean, yes, I'm worried about the Senate. Yes, it would be ideal to have somebody who was younger. Yes, it would be ideal to have somebody who was a minority. But, you know, nobody's given any credible names here, right? I don't know if the governor of New Mexico, who may be a wonderful person but has never been on a national stage, is the right person to step in. We've all watched Elizabeth Warren. We know her strengths. We know her weaknesses. She's been vetted. And you bring her on now and you have a chance to reshape the fundamentals of American capitalism. I don't think you worry about what the heck.
I'm gonna play the girl card, and you know, the 2028, and look at how old she is, and look at how old he is. I think that's great, because in 1 4-year election, not only will we do a lot of repair, not only will we restore to the middle class what they need, not only will we prepare for climate change, not only will we curb some of the overreach of corporations because they've begun to do it. I want them to be successful. I just don't want them to abuse everyone on their way to success, which is what they've been doing. And so I've got two thoughts. And that is that what she will have done is prepared the way for the first woman president, and it will not be her.
It might not be.
And I've said this over and over again. Paul, when I ran for governor in 1992, I had Bill Curry on the other day. And I told Bill Curry this story. And I ran for governor. And I, you know, I ran against the party chairman and the 5-term congressman in the primary. This is 1992, the year of Bill and Hill. And I beat the party chairman and the 5-term congressman by 2-1. But I lost the election. I got more votes than any Democrat in history, but I lost the election. But I was the first girl to ever run. And what I showed was smart. I could raise money. I could fight with the big boys. I could get the votes. I could do anything. And as a result, I didn't break through the glass ceiling, but I kind of broke a lot. Mm-hmm. And then after that, every other girl won. Every other girl won.
Yeah.
Because I was able to show the ability and the mettle. And what I think will happen with Elizabeth is that Elizabeth will do what she wants. She's the teacher. She's the professor. She's the corporate cop. She's the corruption queen. It's not about being president for Elizabeth. I know this in my gut. It's about fixing it. That's what women do. We sweep it up.
Mm-hmm.
And what she will have done then is really opened the door for a really new bench. a really new bench. I don't know if Biden can run again in 4 more years. I don't know whether he should. And he should evaluate that, and we will evaluate that. Maybe they'll last till 2028, but maybe they don't have to. You know, maybe what they can do is in 2024, basically groom a team. I'm not worried about what happens in 24 or 28. I'm worried about what happens in 20.
Yeah, and I'm worried that Donald Trump is not the president in 2021. So that's really what has to be foremost in our minds. It's great to, advance, justice in terms of gender and race. Yep. But we really have to think, what is going to be the best ticket to get Democrats into the White House? This is a pretty good ticket. This unifies the left and the center.
It's a very good ticket.
And I agree with you, Arnie, that, she might not be the first president, but the first female vice president is a very big deal in and of itself.
Well, she'll elevate that position to a level none of us could even possibly imagine. I know her capacity, and I know what we need of her. So, Paul, I'm going to need to let you go. But before I let you go, I want you to hear something that a friend of mine sent me. And I want to end with this, especially given the challenges we face with COVID-19. And I'm going to send it to you because I think you should probably put this in the Washington Monthly. It's from Margaret Mead. Ready?
Yep.
A friend of mine, Dr. Bayok, is a palliative care physician. He used to be at Dartmouth Hitchcock. And in 2012, he wrote a book, but he included this. Years ago, anthropologist Margaret Mead was asked by a student what she considered to be the first sign of civilization in a culture. The student expected Mead to talk about fish hooks or clay pots or grinding stones. Mead said that the first sign of civilization in an ancient culture was a femur, a thigh bone, that had been broken and then healed. Mead explained that in the animal kingdom, if you break your leg, you die. You cannot run from danger, get to the river for a drink, or hunt for food. You are meat for prowling beasts. No animal survives a broken leg long enough for the bone to heal. A broken femur that has healed is evidence that someone has taken time to stay with the one who fell, who has someone who has bound up the wound, has carried the person to safety, and has tended to the person through recovery. Helping someone else through difficulty is where civilization starts, Mead said. We are at our best when we serve others. Be civilized.
Fabulous. I will steal that.
It's my gift. Paul Glatzos, you're joining me a lot. I'm just telling you right now, it was way too much fun, and you can imitate Bill Clinton anytime you want.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude, everyone. We will see you next week. Ciao.
Change.